Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And so yesterday, the first day of confirmation hearings for Judge KBJ.
Is that what we're going to call her?
KBJ?
Yeah. Kind of rolls, KG Bay.
Ketanji Brown Jackson. And no questions yesterday. It was just the opportunity for her to offer an open statement and for senators to speechify. That's what they like to do. Questions will start today. Lindsey Graham offered this at the outset. If only Lindsey Graham were more stout of heart and more consistent in his everyday life, if he was as consistent, I should say, in his everyday life as he is at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings.
Most of us couldn't go back to our offices during Kavanaugh without getting spit on. Hope that doesn't happen to y'all. I don't think it will. As to the historic nature of your appointment, I understand. But when I get lectured about this from my Democratic colleagues, I remember Janice Rogers Brown, an African-American woman. It was filibustered by the same people praising you. I remember Miguel Estrada, one of the finest people I ever met. Completely wiped out. Didn't make it through the gang of 14, whatever gang I was in. I've been in so many I can't remember. He didn't make the cut. Well-lived life, just completely ruined. So if you're Hispanic or African-American conservative, it's about your philosophy. Now it's going to be about the historic nature of the pick. It's going to be about your philosophy. The bottom line here is when it is about philosophy, when it's somebody of color on our side, it's about we're all racist if we ask hard questions. It's not going to fly with us. We're used to it by now, at least I am. So it's not going to matter a bit to any of us. We're going to ask you what we think you need to be asked. And Senator Hawley, you need to ask her about her record as a district court judge. You should. I hope you do. And we'll see what she says. Very fair game.
Now, yeah, it is fair game. And they should ask difficult questions on point. And he is right to point out their hypocrisy, as we pointed out throughout the run-up to her nomination by President Biden, the hypocrisy of the left when it comes to race or any other identitarian characteristic, that when it's on their side, it's the focus on making history or the focus on advancing a representative of some oppressed class. When it's Clarence Thomas or Janice Rogers Brown or Miguel Estrada, it's, a product of the extreme right wing. And there's no mention of race or gender. There's just, this is somebody that has to be defeated. In fact, the left's actual position, the identitarian's actual position, is those individuals like Janice Rogers Brown or Clarence Thomas or Miguel Estrada are race traitors, isn't it?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I was worried yesterday, though, in her opening statement, which she talked about her love for family and God and her the Constitution.
I hope that you will see how much I love our country.
Uh-oh.
And the Constitution and the rights that make us free.
Of course, I mean, these pro forma statements, and as I've said before, and we said yesterday in our conversation with James Copeland from Manhattan Institute or City Journal about this, about her, she seems perfectly affable, interesting life, interesting family.
But she's patriotic and loves this country, which we think is admirable, but other people on the left do not.
Yeah.
And her family was there, her parents were there. Her children were there. Her husband was there wiping away tears.
They gave me an African name, Ketanji Onyeka, which they were told means lovely one. Unlike the many barriers that they had had to face growing up, my path was clearer, so that if I worked hard and I believed in myself in America, I could do anything or be anything I wanted to be.
Well, if only statements like that were followed by jurisprudence consistent with that statement. That's the problem is, that's not the position of the Democrat Socialists. And that's not the position of the identitarian left. The position of the identitarian left is that America hasn't advanced one iota from 1965 Selma, from 1865 America, for their
like it's
for
hard
that
for
matter.
The people to certain groups of people to vote.
And so she says that. But then, you know, we'll see what kind of decision she makes on things like quota cases at when it comes to admission policy, universities and other such cases. We'll see. Going back to Lindsey Graham and the tough questions. So this is how the left responds. And, of course, his whole, you know, we were spit on and during the Kavanaugh hearings and so on and so forth.
That was a circus.
Well, of course, it's not going to be the same. And that's okay. It shouldn't be the same.
I don't want to ever see that again.
Well, the point is you shouldn't make something up out of whole cloth.
Right.
Because the left did it doesn't mean you respond in kind. Sometimes you respond coming over the top with decency when it comes to the indecent. And that's perfectly appropriate. So people have two models from which to choose. You can be part of the hysterical left that suborns perjurious testimony from a, you know, marginally together Christine Blasey Ford and goes full character assassination because they can't really attack Kavanaugh on the merits. Or you can go the way that Senate Republicans are going to go, which is Ketanji Brown seems like a perfectly nice lady, and she's been through this process before, and I disagree with a lot of her jurisprudence, but we're going to ask questions on point, some of the decisions that she has made as a circuit court judge and then in her short time as an appellate court judge, and some of her personal philosophy when it comes to the Constitution relevant to cases that are coming up in this term and will certainly come in the next term and will certainly come up in subsequent terms. And so on that matter of her record when it comes to sentencing sexual predators, you know, Lindsey Graham made mention, Josh Hawley is perfectly within his rights to ask her about that. And Josh Hawley from Missouri provided a look at what he is going to ask when it comes his term for questioning yesterday on Fox and Friends. Here's the Ketanji Brown record that he wants, Ketanji Brown Jackson record that he wants to ask her about.
Well, it's her record, Brian, is really what concerns me. And in particular, just to take one example, if you look at what she's done with child porn offenders, while she has been on the bench, Judge Jackson, in every case in which she's had a child porn offender in front of her, she's given that person a lenient sentence, lower than what the federal guidelines recommend, lower than what prosecutors from the government sought. And in fact, she did it in case after case. And going back to her time on the Sentencing Commission, Brian, before she was on the bench, she wanted to eliminate the current mandatory minimum sentence for child porn offenders. As far back as law school, she talked about questioning whether child sex offender registries are even constitutional. So this is somebody, I think, who has a lot of issues when it comes to being lenient with criminals, soft on crime. And I just want to know, is this a person who's going to protect our kids or who is going to protect child sex predators? And we need to get those answers.
Of course, you won't be sentencing people to prison, but there are all kinds of issues related to the law and the law that governs convicted sexual predators that could make its way to the high court. This is how the left reacts to that sort of questioning. Elie Mystal on MSNBC. This is Fat Don King. And Don King was not slender.
But Don King got the lap band surgery, didn't he?
I don't have access to his medical records. I'm not
Mike's
sure.
Mike's like me, might have eaten his way out of it, like Chris Christie did.
Elie Mystal on MSNBC on this hearing and this notion that Josh Hawley would ask her about her record as a judge. You know what that means? That means Josh Hawley is trying to get Ketanji Brown Jackson murdered.
Oh, God, please.
The simplest thing for Republicans would be to kind of have a normal kind of above board hearing, let her be confirmed so she doesn't change the balance of power of the court anyway, and go back to talking about the things that work for them, you know, to go back to crying about gas prices or talking about Hunter Biden's laptop or whatever other thing counts as a Republican platform these days. Because she is going to be confirmed, and she is going to be well-liked while she's confirmed, and she's not going against her is kind of a waste of their time. But I don't want to let the Josh Hawley thing lie, because here's, you know, like, here's where I need the Democrats to step up. Because when they try to smear her, I need the Democrats to get up there and defend her just as vociferously as Lindsey Graham defended alleged attempted rapist Brett Kavanaugh. Like, I need that level of energy from the Democrats, especially when they come at her with this trumped up alleged issues about her sentencing on for sex offenders. Because what Josh Hawley is doing, let's be very clear. What Josh Hawley is doing when he tries to do this is he's trying to get her killed.
Ali Mussel, officer of the court.
Are you kidding me?
He's actually an attorney, too, which also says something about, you know, how rigorous it is to become an attorney. Oh, counselor this and esquire that, please. So that's what the left does when they don't have a nominee from the Republican Party to accuse of ridiculous things and to whose character they can assassinate. They go after people who would question any of their nominees, even on the merits of their actual professional record. It's just something to behold, the left. And it must be something to have to affiliate with them because of rank ignorance, hatred, misunderstanding, an emptiness inside you, because that's the only thing the only type of person I could see that is attracted to the Ali Mussels of the world and their representation of their views in that Democrat Socialist Party that's headed by the big guy.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the opening day of the Judge KBJ confirmation here in Ketanji Brown Jackson. And Republicans are taking the opportunity to point out the left's hypocrisy when it comes to the treatment of nominees, when it comes to the treatment of minority nominees for federal courts. Lindsey Graham pointing that out. Josh Hawley telegraphing that he wants to talk to Ketanji Brown Jackson when questioning begins today about her record as it pertains to sex offenders. And, you know, there's some nuance here. There's a difference between somebody who's a pedophile. Right. And somebody who consumes child porn, I mean, in terms of the sentencing before the law.
Yeah, because I just asked you, why would she question the sex offender registry?
Well, as Hawley pointed out, going back to what Ketanji Brown Jackson said in a Harvard Law Review article, that, for example, a sex offender registry list leads to, quote, stigmatization and ostracism, suggesting that policy is driven by a climate of fear, hatred, and revenge against sex offenders. Well, a reckoning is part of justice. And this is the sort of kind of philosophical question that I think would be useful to explore. And you go through specific cases, and perhaps that implicates Supreme Court precedent, and you get her judicial philosophy. And that's substantive. I know Ali Mussel says any such questions are trying to get her killed. No, we're trying to understand who she is. And let's, regardless of whether it's a fait accompli that she's going to get confirmed or not, how about using the opportunity of a 4-day confirmation hearing to do more than speak to your navel? How about you actually treat it like a con law class and explore her judicial philosophy, her understanding of case law, what she was thinking with this specific decision she rendered on specific matters, make it a bit of an education for the few people who actually tune in. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And the thing that Lindsey Graham pointed out, which is obvious, the disparate treatment of minorities based on their political philosophy and judicial philosophy. This is a reminder about this construct that Josh Mitchell from Georgetown University, professor of political theory there, we talked about last week, has put forward. Understand, and this is another opportunity for it, another opportunity for Republicans to beat this drum, you know, and illustrate it in terms of a conversation about these matters. That the race war the Democrat socialists are fomenting, it's not black versus white. It's black versus black and white versus white and Latino versus Latino and Asian versus Asian. It's the right kind of white person against the wrong kind. Joe Biden, right kind. Donald Trump, any Donald Trump judicial nominee, Supreme Court nominee, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, doesn't matter, wrong kind. Clarence Thomas, wrong kind of black. Ketanji Brown Jackson, right kind of black. AOC, right kind of Latina. And,
who's a wrong Latina?
Pick one. Linda Chavez, wrong kind of Latina. I mean, you know, they're myriad. You get the point. It's exactly what Graham said. It's about conservatism, or more to the point, straying from leftist orthodoxy, refusing to be an identitarian, refusing to define yourself mainly on the basis of your race or gender, that riles them, that makes you a race, gender, sexual orientation traitor, a la Richard Grenell, wrong kind of gay. Peter Thiel, wrong kind of gay.
That's right.
So it's the same thing. But understand that, because, of course, the media wants it to be black versus white, racist this and racist that, and should always take that opportunity to recast it as what it actually is, which is race matters when it's them promoting, race matters when it's us promoting, but in 180-degree different directions. Jordan Forest Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I think Lindsey Graham missed a golden opportunity. I think what he should have done, along with the other Republican senators, was to have a list of five African-American women that they would support right now for the Supreme Court based on their records. And then now you're going to be people are going to wonder, here we go. It's not about race. It's about that. It would perfectly point out the hypocrisy of the whole process. Now, you know, you have Biden can pick whoever he wants. But that, at least you'll set that aside, that it's not going to be about race. So they should have done that first. And they knew this was going to happen, you know, when Biden was not elected. They should have had this already set up. So I think that's what I would do if I was them right now.
Come up with a list of five black female leftist,
that's correct. Yeah.
Leftist
yeah,
candidates.
Because no matter what, that's probably where Biden's going to be going. So
why would I put forward somebody whose judicial philosophy I disagree with? I mean, I could put forward Janice Rogers Brown, like Lindsey Graham invoked.
Well, okay, but that would eliminate the Republicans could say, here are five African American women that we would support based on their record, and Biden would have to say, well, we don't want them, and so why don't you want them? Because of their philosophy, not their race.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for the culture. Well, he did that when he mentioned Janice Rogers Brown. She's still alive. She could be nominated to the high court. She was an appellate court judge. So, you just need one. We supported Janice Rogers Brown. You didn't. Why? Just focus on Janice Rogers Brown. I mean, yes, there are others you could name, but just one. Just explain it, because we know her record, and we know that she was confirmed to the appellate court. How did that work out? Was she a tool for the radical right? Focus on one example. But I agree. By the way, you know, this obsession with identitarianism by the left is continuing to push at least Latinos toward the GOP. Interesting survey out that was done in sort of a bipartisan fashion. It included a Latino Democrat pollster in partnership with a conservative Spanish network, the Americano network, to be specific. More Hispanic Democrats than Hispanic Republicans are considering leaving their respective parties, and the margin is double digits. Still, it's more than 2-1. American Hispanics identify as Democrats, 48% to 23% that identify as Republicans. But Jorge Arizurieta, president of the Americano Network, said, "The results show good news, but not great news for the Republican Party and conservative candidates. We confirm what we thought might be true. Hispanic voters are moving toward the center right, but continuing this trend will require engagement by the party and its candidates. Republicans must show up in the Hispanic community." Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly what that means. It's always the politicians and pollsters, political operatives always say that, like, everybody lives in the same place. I mean, I understand there are concentrations in particular neighborhoods and particular urban centers, but the over-the-top overture is what is key to me. Hey, we are banking on Latino voters putting us over the top in 2022 and 2024. You know, we need Latino families who believe in these things like we believe to be a integral part of our governing coalition. It's not that complicated. Is that being present in the Latino community, whatever that means? Yeah, I know. Yeah, you have to have local politicians showing up and making the case at the local level, at local events and within local community institutions. I get that part. But also you just need sort of a consistent, simple Red Rover, come over. You're going to be part of the power sharing that any good governing coalition has to include if we're going to be successful. We can't be successful without you. That's what we believe. And then let's go through the panoply of issues. It's not that difficult. It just requires a little bit of stick-to-itiveness. You can just say it once or include it when it comes convention time. Just sort of be consistent about a vision for how you're going to achieve victory and for what purposes you desire victory. This is always like more complicated. People make it more complicated than it needs to be. And it's not a resource issue, particularly not at the national level. Speaking of race, while we're on the topic, we got another budding Jussie Smollett. And here again,
in Chicago, or is this a different?
No, this is in upstate New York. But here again, why is it important to exact justice in a high profile case like Jussie Smollett? Because of the race hoaxes that pop up around the country and have ever since the identitarians gained command control of our cultural institutions and decided that they need an endless supply of racist incidents to make their case that America is indelibly racist and white people are oppressors and black people are victims and they perpetually are and so on and so forth. And where there is no supply, they will create supply to serve their demand. Our Lady of Mercy School for Young Women, private all-girls Catholic school, grade 6 through 12.
Okay.
The graffiti in the bathroom routine. Graffiti in the, girls' bathroom, because it's only girl students. Quote, "This school is filled with a bunch of N-word, get out or else." And then somebody took a picture,
and then it went viral.
Social media, and then the local network affiliate covered it, and everybody was wringing their hands, and so on and so forth. The school investigated, as did the local police department.
And let me guess.
They hid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
"Our Lady of Mercy School for Young Women has concluded our thorough investigation into the racist graffiti incident that was brought to our attention early Monday morning. The investigation led by Brighton Police Department with full cooperation, blah, blah, blah. During the process, one of our students confessed to writing the graffiti in the girls' bathroom. For legal reasons and in accordance with Mercy's confidentiality practices, the student will not be identified. Mercy has zero tolerance for this kind of behavior. Appropriate maximum disciplinary action will be taken." Oh, really? "Even though closure has come to this single incident, there's so much more work to do to understand what people are feeling and fearing. Our students in our community are distressed and hurt." Oh, everybody's hurt. "Mercy will work to help heal the wounds caused by this incident, as well as help heal deep-rooted related feelings this incident has brought to the surface." So was it a white kid or a black kid?
Sounds to me like it was a black kid that wrote that on the wall. Going out on a limb, maybe. Well, but regardless, it was one person.
Well, but that's the school's response. All right, we're not going to disclose. And then they go into this full, like, everybody's heard deep-seated root causes. We're going to work to heal. Bob Lonsberry, radio talk show host for stations in Rochester and Syracuse, New York, tweeted out, four sources, including two in government, had confirmed the N-word graffiti found in the Mercy High School bathroom wall was written, which led to, by the way, protests, of course.
Oh, okay. And probably walkouts, school walkouts.
Was written by an African-American student.
Mm-hmm.
There was a suggestion that his tweet was inaccurate, but not in the way you might think. Some people responding to his statement, this radio talk show, saying, "Not true. She is Hispanic." Well, whether it's Hispanic or white or black, we don't know. It seems like the argument is between black and white from those in the know or think they're in the know, but the school won't disclose. But I haven't heard about this being picked up by the race grievance hustlers. And so one wonders if there's any there, probably not. And whether, again, it's a Latina student or a black student, that's sort of a secondary issue. The real issue is feeling the need to play the role of the victim to get attention. And these high-profile race hoaxes like Smollett feed this pathology among young people that they need to be obsessed about their race. They need to understand whether they're an oppressor or victim based on their race, not their behavior. And they need to get attention on that basis. It's a real cultural sickness.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We still have some COVID work to do. And one of the things we started talking a bit about at the end of the show yesterday is remembering who did what during the last 2 years. Remembering who was civil and accommodating and who was hysterical and cruel.
And friends we've lost because of their hysterical behavior around COVID mitigations.
Well, right. Okay. But I want to focus on businesses, places of
family, a business,
places of public accommodation.
Okay.
Because, you know, I want to think about where I want to go and don't want to go as we emerge from this and we're all getting back to normal and and so forth. And so I mentioned in my neighborhood, Streeterville, you know, near the lake there, D4 and Lisa McNeil's, owned by the same guy. He's a nice guy. I've seen him in both establishments, but
I
know.
Where's
D4? It's right on Grand.
Okay.
Grand, just east of Columbus. But, you know, Grand, other side, Ohio, yeah. The guy who owns it is nice, but I know he's a big leftist. Okay, well, very silly policies during COVID. I mentioned yesterday, this is back, I don't know, in
what year?
Late
the
summer
first wave,
of 2020, walking my dog, and I'm going to stop at Lizzie McNeil's on the river there, McClure Court in the river, to get a beer, sit outside.
Yeah, it's nice out there.
There was nobody on their little deck outside. Sit there. Oh, you can't sit there without a mask on. So, or you can't go in there without a mask on. So that was still back when you could go in, you had to have a mask. When you sit down, you could take your mask off. So I couldn't walk through this imaginary threshold to, you know, basically patio furniture to sit down without a mask on. But if I would get through that imaginary threshold and get seated, then I could take a mask I didn't have off. And I explained this to the hostess, and she's, you know, basically said, well, I'm sorry, that's her, that's our policy, whatever. I said, fine, no problem. I'll never go to this establishment again, and I'll tell my friends. And I never have, and now I'm telling my friends. D4 is the same way, same philosophy, same ownership. Bub City, that's sort of like a country western field joint in River North, had a run in with a waiter. Again, you sit down, you can take your mask off. This is that time. Early first wave, and get up to go to the bathroom. You can't go to the bathroom without,
you know, a mask. In New York City, you can, but in Chicago, you couldn't.
And so
you had to put it back on.
So had a back and forth with him, trying to work the logic of his position, and he was very enthusiastic about his position. I was rather amused.
Well, he was saving lives, Dan.
Yeah, I was rather amused by his enthusiasm, and so Bub City would be another one on the list. What are some businesses, suburban or Chicago or exurban or downstate, that are on your list? Because I want to get a running list and distribute it about the businesses that behaved shamefully and the businesses that did the best they could to try to balance the competing interests, comply with the law, keep their business going. I mean, we had this whole Rebel Diners Club that we talked about in this show. We went to. It started by Tom Sedaka, and you know, I think the first one was Kai's on North Avenue in Glendale Heights. They stayed open. Remember, they put on their sign, you know, this is our business, our family. We're staying open. We're to that effect in sort of defiance. And the local municipal authorities left them alone. And the Pritzker goon squad, which was just the state police, they don't have the resources to go after every business that's in defiance of Jelly Belly's mandates, so they stayed open. And we went there, and then we went to other restaurants around the region over the course of several months, and it was great. So I want to remember those places, too, who stood up against the state and said, you're not taking what I work for or my family work for or generations of my family work for. You're not just taking that away. And what you're doing is not sensible. And so I'm not going to comply, and I'm going to try to provide an example for others. They're trying to rally people in the throes of the fear that was induced in so much of the population.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. For me, it was a Bloom Veterinary Clinic on Clark Street. Would not let me go in with my very sick dog. Dogs can't advocate for themselves. I don't want to talk to them on the phone and tell them how I feel my dog is dying. I need to be in person, vaccinated. I brought my vaccination card. I'm like, I'll put on 5 masks, please. And there's every vet in Chicago, shame on them. When you had to put a dog down or a cat, they would come out to your car and look at you as if you were infected, but you're not, and inhumanely put your dog down while it was on your lap if you chose to do that. If not, they say goodbye to your dog or cat here. We're taking them in and never to see them again.
All right. Bloom Veterinary Clinic. Okay.
Shame on them. Oh. And then I wrote them an email telling how, you know, how their behavior is just disgusting. And they shared it with all vets. So now I can't go to any vet in Chicago because I went
sure
to Duke Animal Hospital.
I'm sure there's.
Oh, no. I go out to the suburbs now. I was at an event veterinary clinic, Dan. And she said, I saw that email that you wrote to Bloom and you have to leave. Like, okay. So Duke Animal Hospital is on that list.
Okay. Now. All right, Bloom and Duke. All right, fine. That's fair enough.
I've given them tens of thousands of dollars, and I love those vets, but no, they were out of their minds.
Sometimes,
they were holier than thou.
Sometimes you may love a place, but sometimes the behavior is such you have to let it go.
If nurses and doctors acted the way that the veterinarians have been acting, we'd all be dead. And same with teachers.
Well, some of them did. Many of the teachers did. I mean, what do you mean if they acted veterinarians?
I'm saying if teachers were nurses, we would all be dead because teachers felt like they never needed to go back to in-person learning. Everybody else could do their job. And we saw you, teachers. We saw you getting your hair cut. We saw you at that party. I saw you. I saw all of you.
Well, and then there's good businesses, too. The businesses that, like I mentioned, Kai's, many others. I want to mention those, too. So, two lists. Where can you go? Because I don't know if a lot of restaurants understand this. There's a lot of substitutes for what you do, for the food that you provide. A lot of substitutes out there. So let's figure out where we don't want to go, because we don't want to support people who are cruel, and where we do want to go, because we want to support people that are courageous and industrious and are just trying to make a living and be, good, independent Americans. Top of that list, in addition to Kai's and others, Nini's Deli, right? This is that place in Westtown I keep talking about. It's on 543 North Noble, and I think we had this guy on. I think he called in one time. Juan Elias Riesco, he's the son of the owner. He told Wilmette talking to Winnetka News back in January about the fine that he got from the city, that his Westtown Deli got from the city. We believe the vaccine mandates and the mask mandates are unconstitutional and ungodly. We believe the mayor and her regime should repent. We fear God and God alone. So put Nini's Deli in Westtown on your list. Etta, which is in River North. I think that's the longtime Fox News, the little guy. Fox News
Luke Kanellis.
Luke Kanellis. Isn't he part of that,
did
Etta?
Did you just say the little guy?
Yeah, like this.
Well, he's a little taller than that. I love Lou.
I mean, not that I'm just
and
trying
wife,
to remember
his
name.
His daughter, they're adorable. Yes, but what did Lou do?
Etta, he's part of Etta.
Yeah.
So they got fined for violating the vaccine mandate. So they weren't acting as group infuriars for the mayor, so they got fined. Tavern on Rush got fined.
Mm-hmm.
So businesses that got fined for not complying with the vax mandate, that's a pretty good indicator. Backyard Grill on North Pulaski.
We need to visit these places. Give them our money.
In my neighborhood, I'm surprised, actually, at this place, because it seems a little granola-y to me. But
Bubba Gump Shrimp?
I actually like it. No. Coupatol, which is like a coffee and bakery type joint, right in my neighborhood, right next to Carson's in Illinois. Sushi Koi on Clyburn.
Oh, yeah.
Bacon and Jam on West 111th. Casa Margarita.
That sounds good right now.
Oh, Casa Margarita's in my building. Well, that's good.
You should go frequent
well,
there.
I have gone there.
And they're still open, right?
Yeah.
Good.
Milk and Honey Cafe, 1900 block of West Division. Scoops, 5300 block of North Central. La Colombe Torrefaction on Armitage.
Wow, good for them.
Popeye's Chicken on East 95th.
Good.
Clark El Ranchito Corp on 4600 North Clark. Outdoor Grill, the Halal Guys, China Ho Restaurant, La Bora Del Cafe, Delaware on Delaware Place, Moretti's, Ecanto, Indio Cocina Mexicana, Hollywood Grill, North Avenue. That's a staple late night after,
some spirits. Good times at the library. Yeah.
Captain Hook's on West 13th. All right, so I just want to continue to add to the good list and the bad list, and maybe we'll pull this all together and put it out into the social media space for people to add their own.
Real quick, Zia's and the Piggery were amazing during this whole time.
Okay, in Edison Park.
Edison Park. No, now they're in Norridge.
Which
they closed the Edison Park location. They closed the Chicago location. Now they're
Zia's is in Norridge.
Yeah, because they bought their own property. It's their own place, and the menu is amazing.
And where's the Piggery?
The Piggery's at Ashland and Irving.
Oh yeah, okay.
Next to the diner, in the world.
Yeah. All right, very good.
Because they were not, once you showed your vaccine card once, they never, it was okay. We got you,
Susie Northside.
Good morning. I just wanted to mention about Swift and Sons still staying in lockstep. My friend called the other day, and they require a vaccination card. So Swift and Sons at Fulton and Morgan.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Susie.
SoulCycle still requires a vaccination pass to get in.
Swift and Sons. Gosh, if only there were another steakhouse in Chicago I could go to.
Oh wait, but you can.
Swift and Sons, good to know. So they're definitely on the do not patronize list. Never go there again. Thanks for the heads up on that, Susie. And on the opposite side, I was just there last weekend with a couple of friends, Chicago Cut, and I understand from people who frequent that restaurant more than I do that they did a pretty good job during COVID of trying to keep everything normal and respectful and
good.
Sane. So Chicago
they wouldn't
Cut.
Yell at you if you got up to go to the bathroom without your mask on.
I don't think so.
That's humiliating. It's just so stupid. And they know it. They know it's stupid, too.
So Chicago Cut, there's your better than actual substitute for Swift and Sons. No problem. See how easy that is? Rick, Northwest Side.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Amy, I'm so glad you're doing this. I've been wishing for a while someone would put these places out there so that people know not to go. The one I have, Alarmist Brewery in Chicago. Very eager to ask for your vax card just to sit at the bar and order a beer.
What? Which one? Which brewery?
Alarmist.
Alarm. Where is that?
I don't even know where that is.
I don't know that.
It's not too far from you. It's like Peterson and Pulaski area.
Oh, okay.
We've been there for a while. It's kind of tucked away in an industrial area, but there's several other really good microbrewers around here that we were able to go to during lockdown that weren't like that. But this one, I will never go there again, and I will never purchase their products at Binny's again.
Okay, Alarmist is they're done. And wait, you, other microbrewers that you went to, so you want to give names for the good list?
Short Fuse out in Franklin Park. There's a new one on Northwest Highway in the downtown Edison Park area. I believe it's Illuminated or Illumination.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I don't remember, but, yeah.
Okay, all right, very good. Thanks for the call, Rick. Oh, this list is coming together nicely. Yeah. Karen Beecher.
Hey, good morning. The one and only place in all of Lincoln Park that we found that was friendly was Little Meatball up there on Lincoln. And then also, too, I want to give a shout-out to my husband's restaurant, Scrimenti's in Steger.
I know Scrimenti's.
Completely normal.
Yeah.
You've been there, Dan.
I know.
You need to come out again and get yourself a steak.
I love Scrimenti's. Scrimenti's is great. Thanks for the call, Karen.
Really?
Oh, good.
Okay.
I love it. Yeah, no, that's a good old joint there.
Really? Old school is like a supper club or?
No, it's just an old school, you know, Italiano place.
But when the little meatball.
That's
huh?
what they call me at Scrimenti's, the little meatball.
Hey, little meatball has arrived.
Uh-huh.
Give him his table. I don't want to get any emails. I love Italians.
Don't go full Lori Lightfoot. Don't start talking about who's got the bigger.
Well, clearly she does. Come on, Dan.
Wait, what was I just thinking?
You were thinking about steak.
Well, I was thinking about Scrimenti's, actually.
Scrimenti's.
Oh, no, in Lincoln Park, Little Meatball, my friend's place, Red Lion.
Oh, yeah.
Red Lion is a bar, and they got bar fare. That's a good joint, too, in Lincoln Park, and he's Colin, who owns that, is a great
normal.
Dude. Yeah, totally normal and hilarious.
I just hated the people that were so excited to tell you, masks up.
Right. Well, yes.
Leave me alone. Like the Starbucks crazy people at Ashland and Irving. I pray for them every night I go to bed. I pray for them. They are so COVID crazy. These are young, healthy people that have two masks on and they're standing behind a shield.
Well, you should not go to Starbucks just as a general rule.
All right,
go to no Starbucks for all kinds of reasons. Chad on the South Side.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I've got a couple I'd like to mention here. They're both diverse, as my thoughts are, of course. Rocco's in Little Italy. It's called Rocco's Little Italy, Tinley Park, Illinois. What a great restaurant. A warrior, refused to close down, didn't enforce masks. If you wanted to wear a mask, go with God. Great place. And he's on 159th Street in Tinley Park.
All right.
Now the worst, traveling north, going up to Northbrook, Max and Benny's. Boy, I got tossed out of there. I walked right in there. Didn't even have my mask on. Jumped on me. Was going to pick up some challah bread to go. And boom, all over me. And I said, you're all Jews. And I said, I'm part Jewish. Polish Jew. What's going on here? I said, like Kristallnacht. You guys remember any of that? Where's your papers? What's wrong with you people? And they were belligerent, to say the least. So
you're killing people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Max and Benny's, forget it. But, there were a lot of people out there. I don't want to mention too many of these guys because some of these COVIDiots might want to, get back at these people. We don't want that either.
Yeah.
No, we're not asking for civil disobedience. We're
thanks
just
for
saying,
the call, Chet.
Put your money in establishments that were.
You can protest them if you want. You can protest outside if you want. No problem. Why not? Civil disobedience if you want. If you have a bad actor in your neighborhood, go ahead. Remind everybody they're a bad actor. Remind everybody how boorishly they behaved. I mean, and by the way, it's just so funny. These genteel place of the North Shore is where you have the most belligerent, rabid, intolerant, hysterical people.
Well, that's because our government did that to them day after day, having daily updates for 2 years.
I'm sorry. Places like Northbrook were like that well before COVID. Speaking of which, Nancy in Northbrook.
Hey, guys. I can't say I disagree, Dan.
Yeah.
But there have been some good places. We went to Highwood quite a bit. Del Rio and Miramar.
Yeah.
Were great and still are. And a couple weeks ago, I made a reservation at Galit in Lincoln Park. And the day before we went, I got a text that you need to either have a vax card or a positive test.
Negative.
So we showed up with our positive tests that we did at home, and they kicked us out. And I honestly thought my husband was going to punch the guy.
Mm.
So don't go to Galit. And also, it's not just Swift & Sons. It's all of the Boca restaurant group.
Oh.
They are still requiring vax cards or tests from a lab.
Good point. Check the restaurant. Make sure they're not part of the Boca group. Good.
But it's just none of their business.
So,
and don't they know that it doesn't matter if you're vaccinated?
So you and your husband showed up to this joint in Lincoln Park with your negative tests, and they said all you needed was a negative test, and they still threw you out.
Right. So we left and we went to Bella Notte on Grand, if you guys know that place.
Yeah, sure.
It's a great classic Italian place, and we were welcomed with open arms, and my husband said the entire way there, "See? I told you," so I had to put up with that.
Oh, yeah. The old "I told you so."
All right, Nancy, thanks. Tom Oswego.
Hey, good morning, Danny and Amy. This is not Chicago, but Lakeview Grill out in Yorkville.
Okay.
We're good friends with Jimmy, and they stayed open the whole time. They moved the tables around, made some space, but he put a sign on the front door, said, "If you feel uncomfortable coming in, don't come in. If you want to come in and patronize, come on in." Dan, the opposite side of that, you mentioned Starbucks. I don't go frequent Starbucks much, but I went into one, and I felt like I was in an episode of Seinfeld, the soup Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
When George comes in there and, you know, puts his money down and he says, "Don't be funny, you know, little man." It was unbelievable. I didn't have my mask on, and so I went up to the counter, was looking at some pastries. The young lady said, "Sir, you have to have a mask on." I said, "Why do you call me sir? How do you know that I'm a man?" And her face, I swear, went dead. She didn't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I put my mask on, got my coffee, and left. But there were definitely two different sides of the spectrum during this whole thing. And anyways, kudos to Lakeview and a few other places out here in Kendall County. They stayed open the whole time.
Nice.
And that was our sanctuary out here.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tom. Larry Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I got one bad and two good. Don't go to Wonder Burger in Mount Greenwood on 111th Street. They're still checking cards.
Oh,
and go to Bartolini's in Midlothian, and go to 7-Eleven on 105th and Cicero and say hi to Dorothy. She don't care if you wear a mask or not.
All right.
Dorothy.
Thanks, Larry. And by the way, I mean, your sister in Elmhurst, 100 South in Elmhurst. And it stayed open throughout. That was like, talk about sanctuary. That was the place to be. And Elmhurst and Elmwood Park and Orland Park, because of the local leadership, a lot of the businesses stayed open and didn't, you know, lose their minds. Melinda Oak Forest.
Place not to go to would be the UPS store in South Holland. I had to go there for work. I was getting a ride with one of the other guys with probably about 20 boxes. Walked in, we realized we forgot our masks. They refused, after we bring everything in, they refused to take care of us because I forgot my mask. I pulled my shirt over my nose, like, okay, well, at least I'm covered up this way.
I do that too.
And he yelled at me because that was not an appropriate mask.
Oh, God.
And I was like, so we had to take all our 20 boxes back out and go somewhere else. And I swore I'd never go there again.
Mm. Thanks for the call. I got a text from 773 here. My doorman at the Monadnock building hassled me daily. He also forever forfeited his Christmas tip.
Oh.
There you go. Same thing, you know. Absolutely. What else we got here?
I went to P.F. Chang's in Woodfield, required vax card and driver's license. This was yesterday.
Hmm.
Oy.
I saw one. Where's that text? McNally's. Cooper Hawks made us put masks on when server approached. They were ridiculous, Cooper Hawks. So that's, you know, a chain of those microbrewery things. McNally's in Mount Greenwood got fined for refusing to be psycho. So there you go. McNally's is in. And it's you know, it's funny. A lot of the old school places, you know, have the reflect the neighborhood or the community, so they reflect the common sense that exists in most neighborhoods and communities, the prevailing common sense. Of course, there's a little craziness, but the prevailing common sense of sort of handling life. But the corporate joints, the franchises.
Right.
Those were the bad actors. It's so many of the family businesses, the local businesses, you know, that part of the formation of the community. Not that corporate joints cannot be also, but you get what I'm saying. Sort of the indigenous places, common sense, reasonable, trying to work with people that they know and live with every day. Some of these corporate joints where decisions are being made sort of outside the neighborhood, the worst actors. Very interesting.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, you know, the Clash classic London Calling?
Yes.
There's a updated version of it offered by a Ukrainian punk band called Baton, called Kiev Calling. And it goes a little something like this. That's, yeah, and by the way, the Clash has endorsed that rendition.
Okay.
And it's, you know, sort of another indication of the cultural zeitgeist in the direction of Ukraine from the West. And that's great. I understand the desire to rally around people that are fighting for their homeland against a foreign aggressor, that are trying to repel a communist thug and his army. I get that. Makes sense that the United States, in the interests of our belief in self-determination, providing aid and support for Ukraine. But does that mean we should ignore all of the warts in Ukraine as well? That we should give Zelensky whatever he wants, back Zelensky whatever he says or does, which seems to be the position of the ruling class in D.C., let me give you an example of the question I'm raising. And this isn't the first time he's done it. This is pre-Russian invasion. He's done it too. Zelensky announced a ban on 11 opposition political parties, alleging that they have ties to Russia. He provided the list. But he didn't provide any evidence of the link to the Russian government. And this was... And the National Security Council in Ukraine immediately agreed to suspend the parties, whatever that looks like. But, I mean, again, you have a country that in 30 years of independence has been a playground for oligarchs. This is not anything to say about Putin and Russia. Just focusing on Ukraine and what we understand this to be. When you have, I cannot get over this, Republican senators like John Kennedy from Louisiana saying that after his address to Congress, Zelensky is now the leader of the free world.
Stop that craziness.
That is lunacy. And the Zelensky regime, as with previous regimes, both pro-West and, of course, certainly pro-Russian, like Yanukovych, are not without their problems. So, yes, you support Ukraine and you want to repel Putin's revanchism. But let's not lose our minds because we're so busy virtue signaling to one another how much we're in the fight psychologically with Ukraine. How about that? And perhaps let's take this opportunity to learn a little bit about Ukraine and Eastern Europe. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Lee Jones, Professor of Political Economy and International Relations at Queen Mary University of London. He's the co-author of Fractured China, How State Transformation is Shaping China's Rise. Lee Jones, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
So what about this ban on political parties by Zelensky? And as I alluded to, that he has used the state to marginalize political opposition prior to Putin's invasion, hasn't he?
Yes. I mean, the bottom line is that Ukraine is a quite a divided society. As you say, it's had three decades of independence, but it's had very limited experience of independent nationhood. You know, parts of the western side of the country were integrated into the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. There were parts of Poland, and the east was part of the Russian Empire. And the territory of Ukraine was kind of cobbled together under Soviet rule. And so it has, you know, it's very diverse ethnically and linguistically. There are Russian speakers, there are Ukraine speakers, and people speak these languages, usually both in their public and private lives. They share common culture, common heritage. And there are some people who live in, particularly who live in the east and the south of the country, who tend towards Russian linguistically, and they have lots of kind of cultural and economic ties with Russia. And then there are people who concentrated in the center and the west of the country who look more towards the west culturally and economically. And those two sides have basically been fighting each other politically since Ukraine became independent. As early as the 1994 Ukrainian presidential election, it was the candidates were very much polarized around this regional divide. So that unfortunately has become caught up in the geopolitical contest between NATO on the western side and then Russia on the eastern side. So when Zelensky has banned these 11 political parties, which include the major opposition party, right, the second largest parliamentary bloc after Zelensky's own Servant of the People party, the one that is the most popular in the east, and he says, you know, these parties have ties to Russia. What these parties do is they represent forces in Ukrainian society that want a closer relationship with Russia, and they don't want an armed confrontation with Russia. And no doubt, they'll probably receive some Russian support in the same way that the pro-Western, pro-NATO, pro-EU parties have overtly received support from the West. So the fundamental problem, as I see it in Ukraine, is the internationalization of this domestic factional struggle, which is serving to essentially destroy the Ukrainian people.
Well, and then Zelensky yesterday, he merged all Ukrainian TV outlets into a singular platform, and then he suspended privately owned media companies. What was going on there? Why did he feel a need to do that?
So in Ukraine, as with the economy more broadly, the media sphere is dominated by oligarchic ownership. Essentially, in many parts of this post-Soviet sphere, the people who inherited political and economic power after the collapse of the Soviet Union were former Soviet era officials, and their networks, essentially to begin with, criminal networks in the black market economy that had been operating extensively through the 1980s as the Soviet economy ran into trouble. So these groups sort of merged together after independence and became oligarchic enterprises in which ownership and control of the economy became heavily concentrated in the hands of just a few big companies. And those companies have bought up media assets or started their own media companies. So some of these stations, channels and newspapers and so on are used by different oligarchic elites to pursue their own political interests. So what Zelensky is doing by basically nationalizing TV media and putting it all into a united TV channel under government control is basically to create government control over broadcast media and silence anybody that might give a different perspective, for example, a pro-Russian perspective in the war. And it's part of, I mean, this is not unusual in the context of war, right? So any part of modern warfare is control over informational space. So the Ukrainian government is pumping out a lot of war propaganda, as you would, you know, imagine any government in its position would do, and it's seeking to exert control over private media in order to solidify the nation behind the government fighting the Russian invasion.
Mm-hmm. And what about Zelensky and the ties to oligarchs in Ukraine? I mean, that's been, as I mentioned at the outset, for 30 years, an oligarchic playground, just as Russia has been. I mean, it's a bit different, but you still have sort of oligarchic-driven corruption, one would argue. And Zelensky is tied into some of that, too. I mean, there have been stories, they don't get much play, but there have been stories about his offshore holdings and such that call into question whether or not there's some self-dealing going on by Zelensky, like we know there has been with Putin and autocrats of Putin's like.
Yeah, I mean, the two cases are actually quite different in this sense. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Russian economy was pillaged by oligarchs, so former officials, criminal business networks, and so on, as was the case in Ukraine. And that led to, as you say, Russia becoming the kind of playground of oligarchs, and they were just basically looting the former public wealth built up under the Soviet Union. Now, Putin was elected in part because he promised to put an end to that. So when people talk about Russian oligarchs today, it's as if they think that the Russian state is under the boot of all these rich business elites. But actually, Putin put a stop to that. He was elected to stop the decline and chaos that had beset Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
But he put
the oligarchs under state control.
Yeah.
So the oligarchs that wanted to...
I don't want to interrupt, but just on the Putin thing, if you could address this while you're giving the rest of your answer. Putin, as I understand it, sort of, you know, not that he's anti-corruption, he just strategically played the oligarchs off as power centers off against one another. And that's how he, you know, maneuvered his way to power.
So basically what he did is he said, you can collaborate with me or you can be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So he pushed lots of oligarchs into exile or prison. And the remaining ones are either business elites that have basically sworn their loyalty to him, or they're his men that he has placed in control of state-owned enterprises. And that is very different to the situation in Ukraine, where rival oligarchic elites still essentially control state power. So in Russia, the oligarchs are under the boot of the state. But in Ukraine, the state is under the boot of the oligarchs. So it's the inverse situation. So this is the difficulty when we cast around a term like oligarch. You know, we need to think who's actually in control. In the case of Ukraine, Zelensky was elected on a platform of anti-oligarchic reforms to try to, you know, stamp out corruption and introduce free market reforms. But he hasn't made very much progress. And that's partly because the whole state and the political system remains dominated by these oligarchic parties. And he himself has close allies of certain media elites. For example, he made his career playing the president in the TV comedy Servant of the People, which was on the media channel of a well-known media oligarch. And he relies, you know, to prop up his government, to get things done. He relies on cutting deals with some of them. So his anti-oligarchic campaign has actually been very selective and mostly directed at pro-Russian oligarchs, which has obviously just annoyed Russia. So there is a deep problem of corruption and oligarchic control in Ukraine that various governments have really struggled to make any headway on.
I wanted to get to your take on something else, too. This a piece by Walter Russell Mead. And again, you know, we're in this silly place of people are so emotional that any crossword, anything that is not a lapel pin or a social media flag is sedition against the freedom fighters in Ukraine. And that's not the case. This is just about policy, U.S. policy in terms of Western interests, starting with America from our perspective. And understanding exactly what the dynamic is in these countries individually as well as geopolitically. So this is not defending Putin or apologizing for Putin or rationalizing his invasion. But what Walter Russell Mead does, he talks a little bit about, you know, how the rest of the world is actually reacting to the reaction of the West, the imposition of sanctions and so forth. And he makes the point that, you know, oh, by the way, while the West is celebrating itself, China's approach of not endorsing Moscow's aggression but resisting the West's efforts to punish Russia, getting support from South Africa, from Brazil, from India and Vietnam. And he makes the point, you know, that a lot of these so-called third world countries, they don't like Putin, but they're not too down with the West's approach on these things either, because they feel like the West could turn on them, that the West isn't looking out for their interests in sort of a post-Russian invasion world. And we should be paying a little bit more attention to China's, you know, Belt and Road exhibitions in third world country, particularly Africa, but not limited to Africa, also South America, because there's going to be a reckoning, a geopolitical reckoning, if we ignore the discomfort that the second and third world countries have with the Western response.
Yeah, I mean, I've not read the piece that you mentioned, but John Mearsheimer, who's a very famous structural realist professor at the University of Chicago, has been making this argument for years that the interest of the West should be in buddying up with Russia against China, because China is the long-range strategic threat and Russia is not. Russia is relatively weak economic power, right? It's only the 11th largest economy in the world. It's mainly limited to commodity exports. As we can see, it's struggling to make headway in Ukraine, which is a substantially weaker military power. So, you know, Mearsheimer argues that NATO has made a strategic blunder by continuing to expand towards Russia's borders, which Russia can only see as a strategic threat against it. And we might not like that. We might wish that Putin didn't see things that way. But we can easily imagine what would happen if, say, Canada was to join a Russian military alliance, how the United States would react to that. And that's the basic equivalent. And we don't have to imagine very much. I mean, think how the United States reacted when Cuba entered an alliance with the Soviet Union in 1961 and put missiles on Cuba. That's just 90 kilometers off the Florida coast. Clearly, the United States wouldn't tolerate that. And the Russians cannot tolerate a neighboring country like Ukraine, which is, you know, adjacent, very large, sharing Russian culture, language and so on. It can't tolerate NATO troops being stationed in Ukraine. So there are countries like China, for example, that recognize that Russia's security interests have been flouted by the West. This is not wise. At the same time, they recognize that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is disastrous in all kinds of ways. And they're trying to back the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. So they're walking a very difficult line. And as for other developing countries, I mean, they can also see what's at issue here, which is that the West has relentlessly expanded NATO in the direction of Russia. And really, it should have helped to settle the conflict in Ukraine by saying, OK, we're not going to expand any further. Ukraine should be neutral. And that's the best way to defend its democratic and territorial integrity against predation by outside forces. So when Western capitals claim the world is united against Russia, it's not quite so simple. As you say, a number of countries in the global south have voted, have abstained or voted against various UN resolutions because they see that the issue is slightly more complicated than a lot of people in Western capitals are suggesting. And they can also see that this conflict and the sanctions that are being imposed are going to have really detrimental consequences for many people in the global south. So in particular, the impact on fertilizer and food exports from both Ukraine and Russia is going to push global food prices through the roof. We've seen fertilizer prices go up to a level not seen since 2008, and food prices are predicted to rise anything from, say, 30 to 50% for key staples like wheat, for example. And some countries rely on imports from Ukraine and Russia for up to 100% of their wheat imports, for example. There are about 50 countries that depend on these exports for more than 30% of their wheat supplies. So we're looking at serious hunger, rising malnutrition in developing countries. So these are some of the kind of spillover consequences of a war involving major exporting powers. This is not some tiny little country.
Professor Jones, we're going to have to leave it there, but appreciate your time. Sure. Professor of Political Economy and International Relations at Queen Mary University of London. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We mentioned this yesterday, but what we have going on is an overreporting of COVID deaths and an underreporting of deaths resulting from COVID policies, at least in part. And this has been the case for some time, but now we're putting numbers to it.
Good.
And as the CDC, as we mentioned yesterday, the CDC reduced the number of COVID deaths by more than 72,000, which is about 8%, calling it a coding error. They also reduced the number of COVID deaths in children by 24% to 1,341 out of the original number, 972,000, which has now been reduced to about 900,000. But CDC admitted a coding error. So does that restore your trust in the CDC? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. CDC is on the level, and hey, when they make a mistake, they're the first ones to own up to it. Particularly on the number with respect to children, as we've talked about quite a bit, but not limited to. So there's a reduction on that side, and we had a 25% jump in the number of Americans who died as a result of overconsumption of alcohol.
Yeah, that went up 25%, right?
100,000, yes, up 25% in 2020, 25% jump over the previous year, and that doesn't include the overdose, the other deaths of despair categories, the overdose deaths that were at an all-time high in suicides.
Mm-hmm. And drug overdoses. We've seen it all, because a lot of people that didn't drink every day started drinking every day during the lockdowns. And guess what? They didn't stop.
So COVID was real, and it took a lot of people, and that's sad. But the response did too. And what, if any, evidence do we have from all this research going on all the time, funded by the NIH of all places, that finds very little evidentiary support for the policies that were pursued in response to COVID in terms of preventing said death from COVID? I mean, for people listening to this show, that probably seems a little bit past post, but it's not, because this will continue to be debated. And now you should go to your COVIDian friends and say, boy, CDC, how do you think they got it wrong? It's a coding error. That's sort of a big error to make. It took a long time to discover, and now they're reducing it after 2 years of these mitigations. What does that tell you? What does that, what should that tell you about the CDC? How much confidence do you continue to have? I mean, I guess the response could be, well, yeah, they made a mistake.
They ruined so many people's lives because they bought into these numbers.
Well, the other thing is,
health officials, they all did.
These are experts. These are people who we treat as Olympian. We don't question. We just follow orders. Huh. This is sort of the point that Vinay Prasad, who is a hematologist and oncologist and a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at University of California, San Francisco, Dr. Prasad, has been outspoken against this corruption of science over the last 2 years, which is what he calls it. He says in an interview he gave to a recent magazine podcast, what I think is most problematic is that we in the medical field were a bit dishonest in saying we had more confidence than we really did. How many times over the last 2 years did we talk about humility? What we know, what we don't know, what we're trying to figure out. Let's walk a little bit. Let's be thoughtful before we run headlong off a cliff. Nope. That wasn't the choice that was made. He goes on, it's more complicated than just the science. It's science plus values and preferences of the population. What I think is the misstep is that scientists, they have a policy conclusion in their mind that they want, and so they overstate the certainty of the science so they can get their desired policy conclusion. But that is the scientists usurping the political role, usurping, I think, the values and preferences of society, and they replace it with their own values and preferences, which they're completely entitled to have as one citizen among many, but it doesn't mean that their values and privacy should dominate, which is what they did. I'm 100% sure, he goes on, the majority of scientists who could have commented on COVID-19 have self-censored. The people you're hearing are a very, very tiny fraction of all the people that are actually doing science. We have no idea what the average scientist thinks about masking 2-year-olds or vaccinating 5-year-olds. They're very quiet, and they're quiet because they have almost no professional upside to speak out on the issue, only professional downside. Well, that's a real indictment of where we are as a culture when you have scientists the feeling like they have no professional upside to speak out on what they believe to be true by either their reading of the work product of other scientists or their own experimentation and work product. What does that say? Where we're at as a culture. Scientists that don't feel comfortable to speak up to challenge the scientists that have been designated as the COVID Illuminati by the DC press corps, which are the very few people that you hear from that Dr. Prasad is talking about, aren't they? Off by 25% on kid deaths. Off by 8% so far on all deaths. That's a big margin of error, isn't it, for these practitioners of science?
And we shouldn't be surprised because at one point in time, the CDC stopped releasing data about childhood deaths. There was a 3 months there where I know people that were trying to get the information. And we'd call Lurie's Children's Hospital because there are sick kids at Lurie's that have chronic illnesses that come for 2 weeks at a time, then they go back, and then they come back, and they got, people got COVID, but they weren't there because of COVID. But they never wanted to do that. Instead, the mainstream media just kept scaring parents, and the CTU glommed on, and it just kept this lie going.
And so did the CDC. The CDC early data from the agency, 1 out of 34,000 kids under the age of 19 would die from COVID. 1 out of 34,000. That's a survivability rate of 99.997%. Is that what most people believe the survivability rate for kids was? Most people believe the survivability rate was 99% plus for anybody under the age of 60 without a comorbidity? No, they didn't. How many people, we saw the surveys with stop, look, and listen surveys, midpoint in all of this. What percentage of the American, what percentage of the COVID infected die? Remember what the median response was? 10%. At the time, that was off by a factor of about 15. But of course, people are whipped into frenzy because of the fear mongering by the agencies that was amplified by their allies in the press, their PR agents, really. Nicholas Wade, who is a former science editor for the New York Times, has a good piece on this. Journalists or PR agents, this is over at City Journal. Former science editor, New York Times, talking about the COVID origin story. Where's that gone? Still don't know. And this isn't important? It's critically important. He writes of the competing theories, the wet market or the lab.
I was sold on the wet market, by the way.
Yeah, I remember.
Richard Engel.
Yeah.
One story.
The rule for covering such a story is obvious. Write about both possibilities as even-handedly as possible until the truth emerges. But that's not what happened. He writes, but science writers have consistently trumpeted any developments favoring natural emergence while downplaying or ignoring those pointing to a lab leak. And he points out a good example of the designated scientific individual or institution driving the story that they want told through their PR agents who are masquerading as journalists. Scripps Research Institute. We just saw, just referenced an op-ed from Eric Topol at Scripps about Omicron part due.
BA2.
Yeah. No, don't relax quite yet. Don't think those mitigations are gone quite yet. Well, part of that Scripps Research Institute is another, it's led by Christian Anderson, who was on those calls with Fauci and Collins in the beginning, talking about downplaying the suggestion that it came from the Wuhan virology lab. He claimed the wet market was the source of the epidemic. The second paper's group of authors, headed by George Gao, who's the director of the Chinese CDC, of course, had every incentive to back the claim that it came from the wet market or naturally occurred rather than Wuhan lab. And what did NPR report? Scientists who weren't involved in the research papers are calling the new data convincing and a blow to the lab leak theory. The data coming from this research group headed by George Gao, the director of the Chinese CDC. In fact, writes Nicholas Wade, former science editor, New York Times, the data don't detract in any way from the substantial evidence favoring a lab leak. They also offer no evidence that SARS-CoV-2 ever existed in nature, the key to proving that it emerged naturally. Not a single animal tested in the market bore the virus.
Oh.
That being so, it's surely more economical to assume that many positive environmental samples from the market were contaminated by infected people, not infected animals. And he goes through the flaws in the new in the papers that science writers ignore as they serve as PR agents for the designated scientists. He also writes, answers the question, why are science writers so little able to report objectively on the origin of the virus? Their daily job is to relay claims of impressive new discoveries, such as advances towards curing cancers or making paralyzed rats walk. Most of these claims come to nothing. Research is not an efficient process, but science writers and scientists alike benefit from creating a stream of pleasant illusions. The journalists get their stories, while media coverage helps researchers attract government grants, and then the NIH is there over the top to provide those grants, so don't run afoul of the NIH if you're looking for one. Dulled by the advantages of this collusion, science writers pay little attention to in-house problems that seriously detract from their credibility of the scientific research enterprise, such as the astounding fact that less than half the high-profile findings in some fields can be replicated in other laboratories. Fraud and error in scientific papers are hard to detect, yet nonetheless, some 32,000 papers have been retracted for various reasons. The reliability of scientific claims is a formidable problem, but one of strangely little interest to many science writers. We're all going to be saved by science and scientific advances. Science, and this is not, of course, this is not a attack on science. I'm not some neo-Luddite. We want to research and explore and pursue advances in the human existence through the scientific method in every field. But we also need to recognize the limits, and that's where the problem comes in. If somebody gets the stamp of science or stamps himself as science, like Tony Fauci, then we're no questions shall be answered, thus you get or asked, thus you be shouted down for cursing the light of a Tony Fauci or whoever else is designated as the oracles of science by these same press outlets.
And by the
PR
way,
agents.
Yeah, and Tony Fauci is not going anywhere anytime soon. He's not going to retire until we're out of this pandemic. Oh, thank you, sir. We're so blessed by your presence. But who's thought, too, that you would actually, I never cared before who the Chicago public health director was. Did you? I didn't ever cared before who the Illinois Department of Public Health director was. But now you do. And now you care about the CDC and the NIH director and who's making money off of what.
I don't really care about them because I don't believe any of them.
Yeah, but they're the ones that put policies in place. I mean, they advised and gave counsel to Mayor Lightfoot, who shut down the lakefront. Yeah. I mean, it was 2 years ago today that they took, you know, they put covers on the basketball courts.
Yeah.
And put caution murder tape at all the parks in the city.
You're missing the point. The point is that what difference does it make, to borrow from Hillary Clinton? What difference does Rochelle Walensky versus Francis Collins make?
Well, Francis Collins can sing, and we don't know if she can.
That's the only difference. I mean, it's like talking about the mayor of Chicago. Why do I care what the mayor of Chicago is? It's the same policies. It's a different person. What's the difference? They have no credibility on the topics that they talk about. The CDC has destroyed its credibility on the topics they talk about. Forget the journalistic community, quote unquote, larger. Specifically, as Nicholas Wade is detailing in his very good piece, scientific journalists, journalists that cover science. Science is going to be our God. All bow on the altar of science. How's it going? Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, blinded me with science, and now we're right back
Thomas Dolby.
To square one. Bad batch of ramen. That's what did it all.
Thanks for the...
You got your beef, you got your chicken, you got your shrimp, and you got your fat.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Richard, South Suburbs.
Yeah, hey, Dan and Amy. I got some new names for the CDC, the Center for Dystopian Control, and the Center for Distraction Control.
Not bad. Thanks for the call, Richard. Maybe take the D out of it. It's just the Centers for Control. I think Frank and Arlington Heights gave us that.
Yeah.
Bob, West Chicago. Hey, Bob.
Good morning, Dan. I had a meeting March 5th at the council in Chicago at the invitation of the consulate to come there. I took a witness with me.
What consulate?
And in Chicago, downtown.
Which one? There's lots of consulates.
Well, the... let's see. My notes are right here. Okay.
Okay, Bob, consult your notes there. Thanks for the call.
Oh, it's a Chinese consultant.
Mike and Hammond.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I got a couple of points. The CDC is admitting that 25% on the kids is probably 50 or 75%. And for the adults, how many people died because of COVID and not with COVID? And lastly, until we can drum Fauci out of the CDC and or out of being in control, we're never going to get to the bottom of anything.
Thanks, Mike.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
That's a perfect setup because the recently indicted Mike Madigan has been replaced by the should-be-indicted, for all kinds of reasons, Chris Welch, who spent a decade on the Proviso 209 school board, including as his board president. And Proviso 209 has a teacher strike going on right now.
It affects three high schools.
4,200 students. Proviso... The SAT test last year, 88% of students scored below grade level in math, 83% below grade level in reading. Mm-hmm. In 2021, the average Proviso 209 teacher base salary was about $76,000, which is 7% higher than the state average of $71,000. That's before benefits and the like. The Proviso teacher is demanding a 12.75% increase over 3 years, bring their salaries up to north of 86 grand. The school board has countered with 9% to bring it to about 83 grand, and they walked out. Proviso 209 salaries have risen 41% in the last decade. Has the academic performance increased by that margin? No. Oh, and by the way, speaking of our theme music for Ted Dabrowski, in one of the communities served, or more to the point, exploited by Proviso 209, Bellwood, the median home sale price in 2020 was $163,000. The median property tax bill in Bellwood on that $163,000 house, $6,000. 3.72% of home value and property taxes in Bellwood to finance these $76,000 salaries and, of course, the real financing, the benefits for those teachers in 209. 3.72% property tax as a percentage of home value is four times the national average. In Maywood, the rate is 3.65%, similar. So these majority-minority communities that are being fleeced by school districts that do a horrific job of educating their children. Sorry, but those are the numbers. The numbers are brutal in 209. High truancy rate, high dropout rate, the test scores in reading and math are abysmal. And now the adults are talking about whether the adults in the classroom should get a 12% raise over 3 years or a 9%. That's Illinois in a nutshell. Yeah. Meanwhile, you're liquidating the homes of lower middle income families that are trying to strive to get to the upper rungs of the socioeconomic ladder.
And they're in spring break right now. So Lord knows if they're going to come back to school on Monday, they've been off for it and it'll be a total of 3 weeks and nobody cares. They tried to have a rally yesterday. A few parents showed up. It was pretty sad. But that's...
What are you rallying for? To send them back to school?
Yeah, that's what they were doing.
I know, but for what point? That's the problem. This is what we talked about during COVID.
Well, if it saves one life.
This is what we talked about COVID. Oh, yeah, no, it's terrible they're out of school, and then it's terrible when they're in school.
Well, I think it's worse when they're out of school right now.
For more on this, Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
So Proviso provides a example of more to come, as you and your colleague John Klinger wrote about at Wirepoints. Nearly a third of Illinois school districts will renegotiate their teachers' contracts this year. So in a high inflation environment, that should be a fun time.
Yeah, you know, if we've seen anything through COVID is how powerful the teachers' unions are, right? They kept schools closed, and when the schools did open, they did the remote learning. They kept the masks going for as long as possible. The unions have massive power in Illinois, and at Wirepoints we've kind of shown how they have more power than virtually any other state in the country. So think about inflation now, right? Inflation is one of the biggest things impacting people today. We think about gas prices and things like that, but you can bet that these unions, when they see this inflation, they're going to want to make sure that their new contracts, which expire some expire in the next in the next year, they're going to try to get as big a raises as they can in there. And these contracts are multi-year, so these teachers are protected for multiple years. And so, you know, think about the private sector. Nobody has multi-year guaranteed contracts with guaranteed raises and protections. But that's exactly what they have, and they're going to push like crazy. So, you know, if parents don't want to get hit, they may want to get involved in what's happening at their school district, but for a different reason this time. We're talking about contracts.
Well, and I just want to tell you, talking about mitigations and COVID not going away and CTU control, a school, I don't know if you've heard about it, Coonley Elementary School, they're the Coonley Cougars, they've implemented and returned to mask mandates after 40 kids tested positive. None of them are in the hospital. None of them are sick. And Coonley has the highest vaccination rate out of any elementary school in the city. But yet they test everyone because that's what the parents agreed to do. Here's one of the parents.
My understanding is that the kids here are being tested at a pretty high rate as compared to other schools. So, you know, you're going to have more positives. And I think the administration here is reacting well to it.
And Jesse Sharkey's all on board.
What I think it confirms is that we're not out of the woods on COVID, and we're still going to get individual schools where we get clusters of cases. And when that happens, we're going to have to respond appropriately. And sometimes that means masks.
And there's six classrooms today that they're back to mask wearing the entire time during school. Is this their way of trying to negotiate a higher salary eventually when their contract comes up?
Gosh, I don't know. I immediately go to thinking about where the parents. If that whole school district feels comfortable with it, then what can I say? But yeah, I would think that at this point, everybody should understand that the masks haven't been effective. Everybody knows that now, and gosh, you know, it's like the rest of the state's not masked, so it's a little surprising to me. But it comes back to whether people want to accept it or not.
I know, and they're all vaccinated too.
And they're all vaccinated, so. What can I say, Amy?
It's just the stupidity that we live
in. Well, you know, and that's why it kind of ties back to the taxes and the property taxes. If parents don't get engaged and start looking at what's in their contract, they're just going to have massive property tax bills. They're not going to know what hit them. He says usually they don't. And Dan's right about these. You know, I recommend anybody who lives in Illinois, and of course you can drive to small cities and see how they're getting hollowed out and getting old. But, man, I just recommend somebody gets in their car and drives around the South Cook communities and sees what the combination of property taxes, corruption, and high, you know, and collapsing home values. Just go drive Harvey and go drive all those neighborhoods. And it's sad, it's scary, and it's a terrible omen for what continues to happen in Illinois.
Speaking of these hamlets around the state and sort of the post-COVID cash reckoning. Westfield, Illinois, down by Charleston, the Westfield Police Department are permanently disbanding.
Wow.
The decision, of course, came from the village's board. The department said the numerous Illinois police reform bills added even more pressure to the already financially constrained department, which caused many officers to resign from the department. When it comes to crime and that nature of things, the sheriff said the Clark County Sheriff's Office is going to be there to take care of the village of Westfield, just like the citizens throughout the whole county. The village will need to create a plan when it comes to city ordinances and the enforcement thereof. But what about this? You know, before the pandemic, we were talking, remember, I think it was the Lyons Police Department that disbanded or greatly reduced the number of detectives they had because they were facing a cash crunch because of the pension obligations. And that was a story that was all over the state pre-pandemic. Then $186 billion came in and we stopped hearing about state and local governments being cash strapped. Now we're starting to hear about it again. We have legislation kicking around in Springfield to get the municipalities a bigger percentage of state income taxes back. And we have stories like this, a police department disbanding in part, they say, because of the pressure that those Black Lives Matter quote unquote reforms added to policing.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a perfect storm here. You know, like you said, it was finances and it will be finances again. And you know, those police departments and those fire funds, we have 650 police and fire pension funds. So many of them are virtually broke. They have very little money. Then you've got the combination of these cities with declining populations, and you know, we've highlighted that 87 of the 102 counties in Illinois shrank in the last decade, so they're going to have less and less resources. And then you add into this the new criminal justice reform laws, which have been, you know, sorry to use the word, killers for departments, because it's making it harder. You know, a lot of those things don't come into play until the next year and the year after. But it's made policing really hard. So when you add all those things together, it's going to be really, really hard especially for small places to you know, find the personnel who know they won't be attacked for doing policing work. You know, when they do policing, that's when they get in trouble, and to be able to fund them. So it's a really ugly combination. I mean, that spells a, you know, bad sign for what's coming in crime in our Illinois cities.
And on property values, when people talk about the hot real estate market in the suburbs, I just laugh and laugh and laugh, because that's all you can do anymore. If you're that clueless, if you think that math doesn't apply to Chicago, then what can you do but laugh and laugh and laugh and leave?
Yeah, Matt, Dan, we actually hired a new guy, Matt Rosenberg, who's come on, and a big part of his mandate is to talk about crime and the props in the cities, you know, not just in Chicago, but across the state. And, you know, like Lori Lightfoot's trying to say that things are better in Illinois, in Chicago. She was, you know, downplaying the the crime in Chicago, because murders are down by three or four people so far this year. But overall crime is up 36% year on year this year, and last year was a crazy year. So things are bad, and murders are up 74% before compared to pre-COVID 2019. So we're going to have to do some massive reforms, and I think this upcoming election determines a lot of these things. How do we handle a post-COVID world? How do we handle crime? All those things are sitting there on the table to be debated, and God knows whether we're going to have a good debate about that come November.
All right. He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This was White House spokesman Jen Psaki on Friday dealing with inquiry from Stephen Nelson, New York Post, about Hunter Biden, his laptop from hell, which didn't exist until the New York Times said so last week.
Exactly.
And the big guy, and whether or not the big guy is implicated in some of the contents on that laptop that the New York Times has so generously now authenticated. Here's how that went.
Clarification and two questions about presidential conflicts of interest in foreign affairs. The first brief clarification is the New York Times reported this week that the First Son remains under criminal investigation. Does the president still intend to stay out of that case?
Yes, it's the Department of Justice, and I would point you to them.
And my two questions about conflicts of interest in foreign affairs. First, I have a question about Russia and then one about China. On Russia, you told me last year that you were unfamiliar with the Senate report that alleged that the First Son, or a company linked to the First Son, received $3.5 million from the richest woman in Russia. Subsequent reporting indicates that President Biden, when he was vice president, had a dinner in Georgetown with the same woman in 2015. This Yelena Batorina, she has not been sanctioned yet by the U.S. government. How is President Biden navigating conflicts of interest when it comes to sanctioning people who have done business with his family? And can you explain to us what this $3.5 million was for?
I don't have any confirmation of the accuracy of that report, so I have no more further details.
About the conflicts of interest, though, how he's navigating those when deciding sanctions.
What would be his conflicts of interest?
Well, his son's company allegedly got $3.5 million.
Which I have no confirmation of, and he has continued to sanction oligarchs more than we've ever sanctioned in the past, so I'm not sure that's a conflict of interest. Go ahead. Thank you. Go ahead.
I have a question about Russia now.
I think we're moving on because we got to get some more people. Go ahead.
My question about the conflict of interest when it comes to China is, last year the First Son's attorney said that he divested from a Chinese investment fund controlled by Chinese state-owned entities. We have received not even basic transparency about who bought out his stake, when this happened, and how much money changed hands. Did he actually divest? And if so, can you agree
to basic
transparency?
He's a private citizen. He doesn't work for the government. I'd point you to his representatives. Thank you. I think we're done here. Thank you.
I think she was done with him.
For more on this, pleased to be joined by Emma Jo Morris. So you may remember her byline. Well, you may remember now from Breitbart News, but you may recall that she was a reporter on the Biden laptop from hell, Hunter Biden laptop from hell story that got spiked by the D.C. press corps in advance of the 2020 election. She was castigated as part of a Russian information campaign, according to former DNI Jim Clapper and so many of those who rallied around the Biden campaign to try to salvage it in the waning days of that election cycle, which they did. And again, no less than Attorney General Bill Barr, who has not been reticent about being critical of Trump now that he's on a book tour, and even previously, has said that what the press corps did in spiking that Hunter Biden story in the New York Post definitely impacted the election. Emma Jo Morris, politics editor, again, Breitbart News. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. So, what's your perspective on why the New York Times in this moment decided to essentially back the story that you wrote just prior to the November 2020 election?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say definitively, obviously. Thank God I don't work at the New York Times, but I'm imagining that it's like, listen, this was a huge bombshell at the time. It's still relevant, especially given that Joe Biden has now won the presidency. Hunter is obviously under an ongoing investigation. This news keeps coming up. And I would imagine that it's probably a face-saving mechanism for the fact that this clearly isn't going away. They're clearly going to have to keep reporting on it. And the laptop has, I mean, we verified it. It's been verified by a third party. Ben Schreckinger of Politico wrote a book about the Bidens where he went to a few third parties to verify emails and found that they were real. So I think that Hunter is just going to be relevant for a while, and probably the New York Times is thinking, if I had to guess, that we can't really avoid this story. It's 2 years later. We're still talking about it. The American people are still interested in it. Let's just kind of bite the bullet. They buried it in paragraph 24 and say, yeah, it's real.
Peter Schweitzer over the weekend, author of Red Handed and among other books, suggested maybe the New York Times believes that Hunter Biden is going to be indicted and they're trying to frame that occurrence.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely possible. It's definitely possible. I don't know. I can't speak to the motivation of the New York Times, but it's quite an incredible about faith. You know, in a column at the time in October of 2020, they wrote that the laptop was, quote, Baroque mythology, whatever that's supposed to mean. That was the term used, Baroque mythology.
Oh, that's a classic.
So they have a lot of catching up to do. And I guess what better time than the present?
Well, now that the New York Times, you know, acknowledges the existence of it, where is the appetite to find the big guy?
Good question. I don't think there is any appetite. You know, I think they're trying to just do the absolute bare minimum possible. And the truth is, nobody in the New York Times or legacy media universe would have acknowledged this very lead that they're acknowledging that the laptop is real had it not been for Maggie Haberman, who amazingly dared to tweet out on the day that the article was published by the Times saying, by the way, you know, this article acknowledges the authenticity of the laptop. But other than that, I mean, the article wasn't about the laptop. It was about Hunter and his legal woes. And right. Like I said, in paragraph 24 only did they cite the laptop and, you know, state it matter-of-factly that it's real.
What about his legal woes? In the reporting that you did you have any opportunity to talk to law enforcement sources that gave you any kind of indication about the seriousness of the investigation, about where they thought it might be leading and to whom it might be leading to, any of that?
No, I have not. The only thing that I have to indicate what is going on in this investigation, obviously they're not going to say anything official or on the record, but
right.
Breitbart News obtained a subpoena to JP Morgan. That was maybe a month ago or so. We obtained that from a source who got it from somebody who leaked it from JP Morgan. And that showed that they were subpoenaing JP Morgan, not Hunter. So Hunter was not served with the subpoena, and we don't know if he may have found out about it from our reporting. But JP Morgan was subpoenaed for all information pertaining to a list of bank accounts that belonged to Hunter. And they were specifically looking for transactions between that bank account or those list of bank accounts and the Bank of China.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine that it's observing maybe a deal with CEFC, perhaps, that 10% was held for the big guy with.
Right. Yes, oh, yeah. Possibly.
That's a lot of money.
And the rallying around the campaign, New York Post did a good piece on it the other day, the 51 spies, you know, former intel and law enforcement officers now in sinecures on CNN news desks or in academia, who all said that your reporting was classic Russian information campaign. You, by extension, were some sort of Manchurian journalist, and not to be given much weight. And where comes the reckoning for them?
So yeah, I wrote a column about this that's on Breitbart.com if your listeners want to check it out. And see a bit more of a deep answer on what I have to say about this. But basically, I don't think that there is going to be some sort of official reckoning, like, let's say, in the sense that all these spies are going to come out and say, yeah, sorry, we totally made that up out of thin air at the time because we were running interference for the Biden campaign. And then obviously from that, you would have, you know, some sort of big public apology from the legacy outlets that uncritically parroted those, you know, those statements. But I don't think that there's going to be anything like that. However, what I am seeing is that, you know, the term that I used in my column is ink stains, right? So this story isn't going away. It keeps coming back up. And every time it does, we're reminded of, you know, the question, where were these people during the time that this mattered, you know, in October 2020? And this, their reporting is all in ink, you know, or it's all published online. And that lives forever. You can't take that away. And until they ever address this, which they probably won't, they are going to look like fools because their audience, let's say, sees the story, looks up, hey, I never saw anything about this. Hunter Biden had a laptop that was abandoned at a repair shop. What's that about? Obviously, it begs, you know, it begs you to wonder. So, you know, their readers are going to be looking up, hey, what's this about? And when they do, they're going to find all of these copious amounts of lies and spin and disinformation and nonsense that was published by New York Times, Politico, NPR, NBC, CNN, whichever. And I would imagine that that would be a shocking experience and maybe force some reflection by the readers of, hey, like, why do I trust these people?
Well, let's talk about the content. What was found on that laptop? What did you find is the most egregious thing?
Probably that deal that I just referenced. So I published an article in the New York Post in October of 2020. It's about 3 weeks before voting day. And it was actually the second day of the series from the Laptop from Hell series at the Post. And there was an email that was Hunter and his partners discussing a breakdown of equity in a company that they were going to be forming with a Chinese energy company called CEFC. And that company is one of the largest in China. It was run by people at the highest levels of the CCP, and specifically of the Chinese Communist Party intelligence apparatus, which Peter Schweitzer reported in his new book. But so this was a deal with the Chinese Communist Party, obviously the gangster regime that runs China. And, which, by the way, is hell-bent on taking down the United States. But anyway, it lists the equity of who's going to own what in the company and how much. And there's a line there that says 10% held by H for the big guy. And then we reported that about 24 to 48 hours later, one of Hunter Biden's business associates named Tony Bobulinski came out.
Right.
He did a primetime press conference to say, yes, you know, the big guy is who you think it is. Joe Biden had a cut in these deals. I was part of that deal. Joe Biden was involved, 10% held by Hunter for Joe Biden. You know, it was just in writing in black and white that Joe Biden is, you know, in a business to the tune of millions with the Chinese Communist Party, obviously our most pressing geopolitical threat in America.
Right. And so Bobulinski goes on Tucker Carlson, too, and that gets ignored by the D.C. press corps, in addition to the D.C. press corps ignoring or freaking deplatforming the Post altogether in order to suppress your story. And also, too, I mean, you know, you need sort of a crime family chart now to follow all this, particularly if you haven't been following it all along. But I mean, we just last month, Devin Archer, former Hunter Biden business partner, was sentenced to prison for his role in another fraud scheme. You've got, you know, Hunter Biden in Ukraine, in Russia, in China, all these different players, and it all needs to be pulled together. And that doesn't even get into some of the self-dealing of the Biden family when you get into Biden brothers, for example, that was detailed in Peter Schweitzer's book, Secret Empires. I mean, so, and then again, to some extent, in Red Handed. I mean, so there's just a lot there that requires sort of bringing everything back from the last couple of years, like you're suggesting, and to sort of set the table and then continue reporting per whatever the feds decide to do with Hunter.
Yes, definitely. And it's intentionally set up where you need a chart to try to actually visualize and understand what's going on. You know, Tony Bobulinski actually had an incredible anecdote when he came out, in October of 2020. And he said that he recalled a conversation that he had with Jim Biden, with Joe Biden's brother. And he said kind of like, aren't you worried that... you know, somebody's going to find out about this. Like, Joe Biden is meeting with us and Joe Biden is involved in this. And Jim Biden basically said to him, you know, the way we're operating, there's plausible deniability.
Right.
And that's intentional to make it such a rat's nest to try to figure out, if you're just a layman, to try to map out what's going on there. It's on purpose so that it's just so obscure and you start to feel and sound like a crazy person.
Emma Jo Morris, a politics editor at Breitbart News Now. She was the reporter on the Laptop from Hell series at the New York Post before the 2020 election. Great reporting. And it must be nice to be vindicated by the New York Times of all people.
It took a while, but it happened.
I don't need vindication from the New York Times.
No, I know.
These are the same people who got a Pulitzer for the Russia hoax. But yes, it's fun to watch them all,
Yes, have to circle the wagons a bit. Exactly. Emma Jo Morris, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
And who sang And We Danced, Amy?
The Rhythmics.
Eurythmics?
No, I know this one. Justin,
Annie
tell
Lennox
me what it
fronting.
Is.
Annie Lennox's voice is a lot deeper than I remember.
And we danced.
Don't
like
not
a
tell
wave
her.
On
no,
the ocean
you were
romance.
You lived in the '80s. He
we
didn't.
We were high as a dove and we danced.
I didn't ask you to sing it.
Well, I'm asked singing
you who
it.
The group name was
because I'm wasting
band
time.
Name.
Asking them.
It's a restaurant chain.
Oh, B.F. Chang's.
Yes, the P.F. Chang's from the 1980s. Yeah, that's the P.F. Chang's.
Woo! Yep. Arby's.
Arby's, right. Rahm Emanuel was the front man for
Is
the
Arby's?
Arby's band. Yeah,
Darn
no.
It. Can you give me the food? Is it American food? Is it Italian?
Scantily clad waitresses.
Hooters!
Yeah.
The Hooters!
Yeah, there you go. Well
Thank
done.
You.
Yeah, Jeopardy champion.
I have a Hooter for 300.
So the word is that the new Great White Hope, now that Obama's personal rebounder has bowed out of the mayor's race, is Froggy from our gang.
Hi, I'm Froggy. I'm Quigley. Mike Quigley. Little.
Yeah.
He's a little guy with a little neck.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I heard yesterday. The scuttlebutt is that they're looking at him. You know, David Axelrod, the Democratic gods of Chicago. Yeah. Or checking him out. Maybe they'll take him for a spin like they did Arnie Duncan, just to realize that nobody wanted Arnie Duncan.
Well, heads up, you lakefront honkies. Mike Quigley has no chance. He has no personality.
No.
He has no character. He has no chance. But okay, sure, whatever you got. So let's talk seriously, because, I mean, what's the difference, really, about the impact of this. This was a good piece in Real Clear Policy about Philadelphia's Black Lives Matter police reforms, like, have been advanced here, not to the same extent, but what hasn't been done de jure by law is being done de facto in Chicago. So, as I said before the break, do Chicago police do traffic stops anymore?
I have not seen a cop have a car pulled over since 19. Since 2019, since before the pandemic.
I agree. And this was, you know, before the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter rioting and all that, there was already a triple threat, the four-tool mayor, before she was a four-tool mayor, when she was just a four-tool member of that police oversight board, advanced this reform to traffic stops where you had so much more paperwork that you had to compile in order to have a legitimate traffic stop, not get in trouble with the brass. And I remember talking to a police sergeant friend of mine. This was when they did that. The year later, traffic stops are down something like 90%.
Wow.
And I said, yeah, it's not worth it. It's not worth the headache. It's not worth the oversight and the complications that could come, the disciplinary threats that are implicit in all of this paperwork. Well, the city council in Philadelphia passed an ordinance last year called Achieving Driving Equality, which prohibits the police department in Philadelphia from stopping a vehicle for an expired registration, for a light being out, for a license plate not being secured in the regular position on the back of the car, for operating without valid inspection, for a bumper violation, for having material that obstructs views out of the car, like tinted windows, from the front side or rear view mirrors, and for other violations. Right? Well, that's good because the police can then focus on apprehending violent criminals. And remember, you're talking to somebody who's had many, many traffic stops.
Many. When was the last time you were pulled over by Chicago PD?
I mean, I don't know if I ever have been.
Yeah, you're more of an Illinois State police guy.
The suburbs. Oh, yeah, the suburbs too. But I mean, but I understand it to some. I mean, I don't understand, like, you know, 36 and a 30. Okay, but the point is, you see something that's problematic on a vehicle and you have other suspicions, you make a legitimate stop. That makes sense. That's good policing. And Tom Rogan, who wrote this piece, is a former federal as well as local prosecutor, and he was also a district attorney. And he offers a few scenarios, real world scenarios, about how this plays out when you prohibit, either by law or de facto, as has been done in Chicago, these sort of traffic stops. For example, a Philadelphia police officer sees a battered old SUV driving without an inspection sticker. In San Diego, a police officer would stop the car and check it for safety. In Philadelphia, under the Achieving Driving Equality Bill, the police officer has to let the SUV keep going. It turns out the SUV didn't have an inspection sticker because it was riding on bald tires and had defective brakes. It had failed inspection. 2 days later, the driver of the SUV tries to slam on his brakes when three little kids run across an intersection on Cobbs Creek Parkway. The brakes fail, the SUV hurtles through the intersection, and three children are dead. Another scenario. A Philly cop sees a dark-colored Ford Fusion operating without a license plate on the rear bumper because the bumper is missing. Instead, the car has a temporary tag tucked in the back window. In Dallas, the police would pull over the car. Under Philadelphia's new law, the police are not allowed to conduct a traffic stop, identify and cite the driver, and fix the violation. 2 days later, police are reviewing video from a drive-by shooting in North Philly with what looks like the same car carrying the shooters, but there's no visible license plate in the video to check and see to whom the car is registered, and the traffic stop to identify who was driving the car never happened. Another Philly homicide goes unsolved. Another scenario. A Philly detective is staking out a notorious drug house known for sending kilos of fentanyl-laced heroin to the infamous streets of Philly's Kensington neighborhood. The detective sees a male with three prior convictions for drug trafficking jump into the car in front of the house carrying two duffel bags of what is likely to be drugs. The car isn't displaying any registration. In New York City, a detective would pull the car over for the registration violation and try to develop probable cause to search the bags. In Philly, the detective has to watch the drug dealer and the drugs disappear. Meanwhile, in the Grays Ferry section of Philadelphia, a man with an open arrest warrant for homicide gets into his girlfriend's car late one night. He's carrying a stolen gun, the one used in the homicide. Unknown to him, the car he's driving has a broken taillight. He passes four police cars as he drives from West Philly through Center City, then up to North Philadelphia, where he ditches the gun with a friend. In Miami, he would have been stopped for the taillight violation, then arrested for the homicide, and the gun from the homicide would have been recovered. In Philly, the murderer gets to drive blissfully by the Philadelphia police cruisers, and the cycle of violence continues for another night. The value of these traffic stops, now it's not to be, of course, it's not, you know, to be driving while black. It's not to racially profile and so forth. It's to look at cars that are out of compliance or not in compliance with the law, individuals who are behaving suspiciously and use, by the way, what is a legal approach, Supreme Court, to make a traffic stop and ascertain the situation. That's called preventative policing. Have there been abuses of traffic stops? Sure. Police abuses across the board over the many, many decades of policing in America. But when you're talking about the sort of violent crime that is endemic to big city America because of these deprosecution, decarceration prosecutors and mayors, you're sure you don't want police using the instincts developed through training to make legitimate traffic stops. Maybe they, if all it is is a bumper violation or lacking an inspection sticker and there's no other reason for concern, maybe you let the guy off with a warning. But if there is more going on, then you have the potential to stop some of these outcomes that Tom Hogan outlines in his piece. Just trying to like think through dot connecting, because so much of this is just sentimentality and people say, oh, well, that's great because now nobody will get a moving violation in Chicago. And, you know, as the committer of many moving violations, that's not the point. That's not the point. The point is to say, yeah, you know, police presence, know that they're on the stick, know that they're being proactive and they have the civilian backing to be proactive. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro. Text line, Steve, Northwest Side.
Hi, good morning. I was a sergeant in the Chicago Police Department for, well, I was a sergeant. I retired in 2013, I think. Even back then, I told my guys, here's what I want from you guys. I want you to go to your calls as promptly and efficiently as you can, handle the job as promptly and efficiently as you can, and then come clear in a reasonable amount of time. I don't want you doing anything proactive. I don't want parking tickets. I don't want anything like that. You were to remain in your car and do the bare minimum. Because I know that a parking ticket, a traffic ticket, a bus check has a potential to lead to a confrontational situation. And because of the climate, the way things are now, and they were back then, those coppers were going to lose that beef 99% of the time. The system's geared to hammer them, to punish them, to put them in their place. It is not geared to protect them and encourage them to do proactive police work. And for the record, I was a very, very aggressive policeman. I was a very aggressive sergeant. And it broke my heart for me to take that course of action.
That was back when, this is how long it's been going on to people lose perspective on time. I mean, I remember the comment that John Cass seized upon from Tiny Dancer, our previous miniature mayor, police in the fetal position, being critical of police.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
If you're out there today in today's climate, anti-police climate, doing any kind of legitimate aggressive police work, you're out of your mind, because they're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. Everybody with more than 2 days on the job knows that, and that's, you know, that's the sad thing about that. The people that are actually going to suffer by this are the citizens that are go about their business, you know, just minding their own business, take care of their thing. You know, it's just sad what's going on here. And you're right about defunding the police. They're defunding the police by not hiring the police. I think I read where 29 police people took the test for the police department last Saturday. 29 people. We're losing how many coppers are retiring or moving on to other jobs every month? It's just insanity. When are these people going to wake up and see what they're doing to the city? I love Chicago. I moved out of Chicago a few years ago because I can't stand the corruption and the patriot, the patriot, you know,
patronage.
Patronage.
Yeah.
And I had to get out, and I took a huge loss on my home. I paid well over $300 for it, and I sold it for well under $300 after putting $100 into it. I took a huge hit, but I had to get out of there. And I got out of there because of guys like Rahm Emanuel and Richard the Younger Daley and this mutant that we have in the fifth floor now is just, I couldn't live there. I couldn't live there. And it's sad. I actually tried to get on the job, go back on the job twice, because these mugs, these thugs were attacking my city. And I loved that city so much, I felt it was my obligation to go back. Of course, they wouldn't hire me back, but that's another story. But I that's how much I love that city. And I'm out of there, and I'll tell you what, life is green. When they say life is, the grass is greener on the other side, it is, trust me.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
You don't live in fear of getting shot or having someone you love get shot.
The grass is greener on the other side of Illinois' corporate boundaries. Yeah, a lot of people feel that way. John, Portage Park.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to relate a traffic stop that happened May 28th, 1980. This is a long time ago. It was 3 days before I was supposed to report for basic training in the Army. I turned right on red when I wasn't supposed to. Chicago copper pulled me over, noticed I was drinking. I explained the whole thing to him, and I wasn't disrespectful or anything. And the copper just took my keys, threw them on top of a flat building like a factory at Belmont, Milwaukee. He said, "Now, you got to go. You got to go home now." And it really saved my life. I was in the Army for 20 years, and I wouldn't have been able to go in if I had that on my record. So, you know, that was a really good thing that copper did for me.
Interesting.
So,
all right. Thanks.
That was... Thank you.
Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. Mark, Western Burbs.
Yeah, hi. This is a fairly obvious observation, but this new policy is the antithesis of Rudy Giuliani's broken window policy. So now you get these misdemeanors that lead to now more serious crimes. So I think it's wrongheaded thinking, obviously.
Thanks, Mark.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.